Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. Today we'll be talking to Henry Mortensen about poetry, art, and filmmaking. And Richard will begin now.
So thanks for giving us your time, Henry. And I wanted to start out with...
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure, I wanted to start out with something that our listeners can immediately connect with, and that is your poem, Instruments of Deconstruction, which is in the soon-to-be-published anthology, Beat, Not Beat. So to start our conversation, if you could, would you lay this poem on us?
You got it. Instruments of Deconstruction. Violins aren't used much in jazz anymore. People don't say fiddle much these days. Every violin sings its own screeching blues, sheep intestines stretched to their limits and strung up, horsehair held taut by bone meets the gut strings. At the right angle, the scream is beautiful. Piano keys resonate with the colonial legacy, the blood of humans and elephants, the black wood synonymous with the continent, taken to Brazilian plantations that the jungle burns for, hard cinder-colored blocks and their toothy neighbors, totems lined up in a row, ready to pound hammers on the backs of string legions. In jazz, the guitar is in the rhythm section. Flapping picks still resemble their turtle shell heritage. Whalers ate soup and found another source of organic income when blubber isn't enough. The alloyed metals in the horns echo untold histories of cave-ins and polluted rivers behind the melody. The drums pick up, stretch, cured hides of ungulates imitate the heartbeats they once contained. They move, the players sweat now when the band is in its groove. The piano may be pristine or soaked in alcohol, blood, and knotted off junky drool, but there's no avoiding the sweat. Most pieces in the strings have blood from misflicked fingers. Those strings are ready for action. They are thin and ready to test their tension. Will finger skin or gut string break first? All the horns are full of spit, and the woodwinds won't even let you play them without an offering of saliva drawn out into reeds like microscope flies. Smoky rooms solidify into an extra varnish, aspirated, expelled patina, breath and blood, the lives and the hopes buried, realized, forgotten of the players, the pain needed to make sweet screams called music, the pain of this world's life supports the howls spawned from human pain, the source and the victim, the powerlessness when leaving the forest, constructed lives that need meaning and names of new kinds of unhappiness. Our own yelps turn to joy, bone flutes the first evidence of new musical sound drawn from violence, the pain of their species to add to our own. Once the instrument is out of the maker's house, its life is a complement to the lives who touch it. You can scream until your throat bleeds, and nothing beats a used Stradivarius.
Well, I think that's a terrific piece because it is so rich and dense. With the images and the ideas are really we're all working together, and there's a wonderful dialectic between nature, which provides the raw material from which we make instruments of art. And to extract these instruments, or to fashion these instruments from the raw material of nature, involves pain. So there's also, you know, you have to reach a certain stage of civilization, which is built on, to an extent, the exploitation of nature. At least our civilization is. Others, Native
yeah.
American ones, are much more in harmony with nature than ours is. But and this is all working together. So I want to ask you, how did you construct this poem, Henry?
Well, it sort of, it got bigger as it went along. Initially, I just was kind of thinking about the elements in a jazz band and trying to just that connection between jazz and reverse poetry of trying to have a rhythm but have no set pattern kind of at the same time. And then as I was thinking about the different instruments, I realized first, you know, I was thinking about the materials of string instruments first, and then I started thinking about each thing, and even if they're not made from materials that come from animals, you could still argue there's some kind of maybe human suffering or other kind of suffering involved in making them. And then towards the end, I started getting a little general and into kind of human prehistory, I guess, and even when, you know, like you were saying, societies that are more in touch with their surroundings and the other beings that live on this planet, you know, part of life is still suffering and death, and so, you know, even a sustainably harvested bone flute is still made of bone. And I just thought that was interesting that, you know, in a way, also singing is very similar to yelling and wailing in pain, mechanically. And so, you know, and that idea of the blues, of expressing our pain, that the emotional content is pain, but also the medium is pain in a way.
Yeah, and there's also... there's also a political dimension to this. Piano keys resonate with a colonial legacy. And those two lines alone have, that's what I mean by all the ideas in this. I mean, you know, and then there's the blood of humans and elephants, the black wood synonymous with a continent, taken to Brazilian plantations that the jungle burns for, all that entire section. There's that piano keys resonate with the colonial legacy. It's not an accident. I mean, Europeans went to exploit that continent for its material wealth, and this is the dialectic that is working that I see working throughout the entire poem.
Yeah. And it's also how intertangled, like you were saying, that is with our modern Western society or most modern societies, that it, even if you're just trying to play some music, you can't avoid participating in that exploitation. You could, perhaps, but, you know, you're not thinking about that. You just want to play piano, and now pianos are made of, you know, petroleum products generally instead on the keys, which has its own connotation. But, you know, if you were a jazz piano player in the 20s, you probably weren't thinking about where the ebony and ivory came from. You were just trying to express yourself. And expressing your own exploitation.
That's true,
if we're talking about jazz.
Well, that you mentioned the blues. There's this fellow by the name of Paul Guérin, who passed away recently, wrote a book called Blues and the Poetic Spirit. And when I heard about his passing, I pulled it off and I flipped through the book again. And I had what I read in the back of my mind when I read your poem, and I could see this connection of jazz, blues, and free verse all working in this poem. So it's really, I think, a magnificent poem, and I'm really glad that it made this anthology.
Thanks. Yeah. It's one that I revised more than I usually do, and it also, even the first draft was longer than I expected, kind of thing. The anthology, I'm really honored to be part of it. I'm wedged in there amongst giants. So it's a pretty amazing anthology that really does cover, I mean, it goes back to actual contemporary beat poets and just post-beat poets, and there's and then people all the way up to my age and younger. So it's a really amazing collection that that Rich and SA and everyone put together.
Yeah, it is. And in addition to being a poet, you are also a filmmaker. And
yes.
Before the program started, we were talking about Man Ray, in 1999, my girlfriend gave me a copy of his memoirs, and in reading that, I like most people, I knew that he did paintings, he did photography, and he made some films, but he was he did much more than that, and I was thinking that you two fall into the category of artists that work in several media and are accomplished in several media. And I know that in Ray's memoirs, he talked about why he worked in these different media, because within the constraints of that media, he could not do what he wanted to do. If he had an idea for something, a photograph, the idea that he had is something that needed to be photographed, not painted. Mm. Another idea was an idea that had to be painted but not photographed, and so on. So I was wondering, as an artist who works in different media, what is your decision about, I'm going to make a film about this, or I'm going to write a poem about it, or I'm going to draw a picture of it? I mean, what is your criteria for selecting your media?
Yeah. Well, within, like, I sort of, you know, like a broad, but more specific than just all art categories, like writing per se, for example, you know, you have the, like with the poem I just read and that we were talking about, I could have taken an academic approach and written some kind of historical account of, with concrete examples of when instruments started being made of these materials, how long, you know, what the process used to be like, where they came out of Africa. But I liked the idea, for this, I felt I wanted to combine the feel of that music with this writing. And so I think a poem has a more immediate emotional impact in terms of that. And there's tons of people who have done great historical writing on the topics that are in this poem, so I'm trying to accomplish something else with it, something more maybe intuitive and emotional than intellectual. But I think that that idea from Man Ray is a really good way to look at things with art, and just generally that rather than being better or the new version of something, that things are right for their purpose and time and place, that sometimes a style is successful because it resonates in that time and it's relevant to that time. Like musically, something like punk rock, when it started, didn't even have a unified musical sound. It was more about an approach. And that led to the kind of noisy, fast sound that we think of when we think of punk, which accomplished what punk was trying to do at that time, and it was something new and different at that time, and that was part of the point, was that it was shocking, but also simple and effective was a big part of it too. And now it's still simple, but it's been done, so it doesn't have the same emotional effect. So it's not that, like, that was the perfect rock and roll and they figured it out and that's where we should end rock and roll or end bands or music, but there's ways to maybe accomplish, the way you would accomplish what punk rock accomplished then now wouldn't be with punk rock, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense, sure. No, yeah. We live in a different historical moment, and I agree 100% with you that depending on the period of history that we are living in, that provides a certain parameter for the kind of art that would emerge in that history. Otherwise, right. You're going to be excavating earlier forms that speak to a different era, and which is not to say that we just throw them away. No, they are worth preserving because they are the things that you build on. And there, and also to preserve this art is, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel because they have done that already. So you can move on from there and, you know, take your inspiration from the present and what's going on right now and right in this particular historical moment with all of its contradictions and complexities that we are faced with like every single day. And one of the other things I wanted to mention is you talked earlier about you wrote this as a poem instead of as a piece of researched nonfiction because you wanted to put the emotion in. Well, the emotion is there, but also the facts are there too. And I remember I was thinking there was a poem that William Carlos Williams wrote called Portrait the Suckers, which was about the Sacco and Vanzetti case. And he basically, and at that time there were certainly numerous articles and pamphlets saying that Sacco and Vanzetti had not received a fair trial. Their political beliefs were held against them. Their immigrant status was held against them and so on. And he wrote a poem about this, but he kept it factual. He had all of the facts in the poem and basically a recapitulation of the case and a critique of the way that it had been handled, plus going further, the way that it had been reported in the mass media of the day. This was not like a piece of prose writing. This was a poem with everything that goes into a poem, with the music, the ideas, and the images. And that's why I think that you know your poem works so well, because it has all of those things working in it, and it is a poem, and it is evocative of an emotional response, and at the same time, it's informed by your intelligence as well. So I mean, I don't think you can ask too much more of a good poem than that. But
no, thanks.
But as a filmmaker. Go ahead.
To connect with filmmaking, I was going to say it's also, for me, poetry is just as much of I think of it as like an auditory medium.
Yeah.
As much as, even though usually you encounter it visually written, but written it's black and white, like the piano, and then it has a sound to it, too, which is I was talking about music, so I wanted that. The film that I made is called Skating Polly Ugly Pop, and it's a documentary about a band called Skating Polly. And for that, I wanted people to see and hear them. So for me, that's why a film makes sense, because I wanted to share their music and their presence with people. And I wanted to do it in kind of a fly-on-the-wall sort of way, and just kind of give people a feeling what it's like to see them play and what it's like to hang out with them too.
Well, I know that in documentary, the filmmaker shoots more than they finally use in the finished movie. One of the things I did see, I watched it online when it had its premiere a couple of years ago. And one of the things that I was intrigued about knowing, I mean, I wish I was able to get into that Q&A that came after it, but for some reason my computer wouldn't let me in do it. But, so I will ask you now, what were the editorial decisions you were faced with? I mean, you wanted to be a fly on the wall and you wanted to present them, but there was an overarching plan for the movie.
Made itself apparent as I filmed. The original scope I imagined of it was a little bit smaller, more like just a single tour documentary, less encompassing of their whole career. And I ended up filming them for like 2 full years, like a lot of the time, and then another couple years sporadically to get a few extra things. And then was editing during that whole time and for another couple years after. And it's more, I think, with documentary filmmaking, it's more like sculpture than painting, in that it at least in my experiences and from other people who I know, it can be a reductive process. It depends on, obviously, if something is a historical event you're talking about, you have more of an obvious structure from the outset. But if you're going into something not knowing exactly where it's going to go, you really have to look at what you have after and find the story within it, like the way you find a figure within a block of stone, by just throwing everything out there and then slowly taking your stuff away until you start to see an arc. For me, I had for this movie, the band started out as a two-piece, two stepsisters who shortly after their parents met and started dating, and they became stepsisters. They started playing music together. Partway through filming, one of their brothers joined the band, and they became a three-piece. And suddenly I realized, like, oh, this is where it should end, because this is sort of a new band now. After this point, it's a new story, and the more notoriety and success they get, people are going to know about this version of three-piece. So the story I want to tell is the story you don't know about them, even if you do know them now, kind of thing. For me, they're just refreshingly earnest. So I just really that's why, you know, sometimes different documentaries have more narration or less, mm-hmm. or more, you know, talking heads with the interviewer in there sometimes. You know, if it's more journalistic, you might, you know, have someone walking around with the person. But I wanted them to tell their own story, so I waited and waited and waited until it had an arc, kind of, and then honed that arc down until it wasn't. I think our first timeline was somewhere between 6 and 8 hours long. Which there were some full half-hour shows, full half-hour sets, yeah. of the band in there was part of why it was so long. But we reduced it from that to under 2 hours.
Well, so yeah, that's really good to know that it is, that you saw this as a piece of sculpture, as a subtractive process, taking material away until you got the form that you wanted, and. It also, I mean, there throughout the movie, you could see this was a sort of an in media res account of this band, because where it does end, it doesn't end, you know, now they have arrived and this is it and blah, blah, blah. Mm. No, there is an open-ended, like there is going to be future chapters of the development of this
right.
particular band, because, you know, they were just kids when they started out and they have years ahead of them to grow and develop in different ways. I mean, whether they stay together, break up, form new bands, et cetera, that's all open,
yeah.
and that's something to look forward to if you follow these musicians. And I think you got
right.
that idea really well in the film.
Thanks. Yeah, it's also, for me, I think I said that their earnestness is sort of what made an impression on me, and they're very much, what they like about being in a band and being musicians is playing music. They love music, they love collecting records, they love bands, and so for them, that is the only goal, is to be able to do that. It's not to be rich and famous, it's to be able to make a living, certainly, not without having to have another job. Sorry, there's a plane flying over. But they also, there's a point in the documentary where they sort of do have a brush with a sort of stereotypical VH1 Behind the Music style successful record deal, but it ends up falling apart. And, you know, it might have been something that would have brought them more financial success or attention. It's hard to say, but it wasn't the right creative fit for them, and it wasn't allowing them to express themselves earnestly. And so that being from the start what I wanted to convey to people, as the plot arc started developing the movie, I realized that it's kind of the anti Behind the Music storyline. It's the opposite of that arc, and that's exactly what I want to say about them is, and I think that's why other musicians who are older and more experienced tend to respond to them, because that's the reason that they got into music in the first place, even if it got painful or if they lost sight of that or whatever might have happened since then, that it's a reminder of the sort of pure intention that art should be about.
Well, again, I think that no matter what the future portends for them, your film has this time retrieval quality to it, and we will always be able to see to revisit the band at this particular moment in their careers, their progress, whatever. And since Jean-Luc Godard died not too recently, I was thinking of his film 1+1, also known as Sympathy for the Devil. Although his version, 1+1 was his cut, Sympathy for the Devil was a different cut that he disowned. But in the course of, he is filming the Rolling Stones, or part of the movie is about him filming the Rolling Stones recording their song Sympathy for the Devil that was on Beggar's Banquet. And it happened in June of 1968. So that in the course of the several days that they laid down the track, Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. And in an earlier take that Godard shows, Jagger says, "I shouted out, 'Who killed Kennedy?'" And later on, that he amends that to, "I shouted out, 'Who killed the Kennedys?'" So it was it's like I never thought of that until I saw the Godard movie. Wow!
Right.
So that happened there. So that's why I bring that up, because who knows? You know, down the line somewhere, somebody revisits the film and they're going to see things that are probably eye opening in ways that people didn't take in the first time they saw it, or you know, they said, "Oh yeah, that's the way it was." But so I think that's really a tremendous value of your movie, that it has this, and that it is there without. I mean, you were not really intrusive at all in the movie, and I like that too.
I really felt that I wanted to try to avoid any kind of narration as much as possible. There's some titles that function that way, just to sort of avoid confusion, kind of tell you, move things along, but for the most part, it all comes from interviews with the band and other people, is the way that the story's told, or narrative. The Sympathy for the Devil version of that film was one of the, I watched a bunch of documentaries to kind of prepare before I started editing, to think about what I liked about them, what I didn't like, and what kind of thing I wanted to, and that was one that I watched, and I felt that the side of it that was the Rolling Stones that I liked, there was a very, there was sort of a stillness to it in some ways, but it was still very compelling, and it did have that fly-on-the-wall feel, and you were just kind of hanging out with the band and slowly seeing them trying another take, and adding little bits of the song that, for me, watching it, is an iconic song that has been in tons of movies and that I know very well. So it's really odd to see it in that context, so sort of informally almost. But I like that stylistically a stillness, but a stillness that makes you pay attention rather than be bored. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and I got that from your movie. Well, we're almost out of time, so the movie is still making the rounds. Where can people see it now?
Right now, I don't think there's anywhere, but we're going to have a DVD or a Blu-ray soon.
I'm just
finalizing a few things for that. It's going to have four deleted scenes, and there's a couple things, little minor corrections I wanted to do before finishing it. So once that's all done, that will come out from Percival Press.
Okay, well that's good. So listeners, you will have a chance to see this movie on Blu-ray and DVD, and it's well worth it. Check the Percival Press website. They have a lot. They
They have an excellent line of books from poetry, photography, political economy, current events. It's a comprehensive press. What projects are you working on now, Henry? We're almost out of time, so.
I have a couple. I have some acting work I did. I have a horror movie called Night of the Bastard, a satanic cult, very grindhouse, low-budget, running gun style, that's making rounds at film festivals right now, and a small part in Greatest Beer Run Ever that just came out, Pete Farrelly movie. And then hopefully we'll be doing a music project with Curtis Mayo from Skating Polly and Buckethead, the guitarist. I'm not sure where we're going to finish that, but sort of an experimental kind of weird music project we're working on.
Excellent. That's all worth looking forward to. Well, we have been talking to Henry Mortensen, poet, filmmaker, musician, painter. We didn't even get into his painting, but that's for another conversation. But Henry, thank you for your time, and check out Percival Press. Henry is on the editorial staff there. They have a great selection. Check their website out. There's a lot of good material that is worth owning. And Henry, once again, thanks for your time, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. I had a really good time. Thanks for having me.